This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Someone said, one of our interviewees said that when it was 5 years, exactly 5 years after Katrina, when the BP spill happened, and it was like being stabbed in the exact same wound twice. And so it does start to feel like, God, how much more can these people live through?
When we talk about corporations trying harder to do the right thing when it comes to the environment, it's important to remember the consequences of not doing the right thing. Both of our guests this week on Sea Change Radio are trying to shine a light on corporate polluters, but in very different ways. First, we hear from Mike Bellamente, the executive director of Climate Counts. We talk about his group's landmark study tracking the CO2 emissions of 100 corporations. Then, I speak with Lee Fondakowski, a writer who recently penned a play about the BP oil spill, which, when it comes to the stage this March, should capture the attention of environmentalists and thespians alike. Joined now on Sea Change Radio by the Executive Director of Climate Counts, Mike Bellamente. Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Alex.
So briefly for our listeners, what is Climate Counts?
Climate Counts is essentially a sustainability ratings organization specifically related to climate change. So we rate major corporations on their commitment to reducing their climate impact. And for the last 7 years, we've been doing that with the scorecard that we've used that's been widely accepted by the corporations themselves and by a lot of the thought leaders in the industry for the fact that it's consistent in how we rate, it's comprehensive, and it's easily accessible to the consumers.
And you have an important new study out, which I highly recommend listeners download and read for themselves. But the study is to take what we know about climate science and then apply it to what we know about the current state of corporate greenhouse gas emissions. And why don't you tell us the methodology behind this? You say this is like the first of its kind in that it takes into account the science.
In the same breath, as I say, we've been consistent in our and how we've scored companies for the last 7 years. This is somewhat of a departure from our traditional scoring methodology. And as you said it, it's looking at corporate emissions performance through the lens of climate science. And to give a little background on that, so how we've traditionally looked at company performance is across four criteria. Basically, is a company measuring their greenhouse gas emissions? Do they have a commitment to reduce those emissions? And are they reporting out coherently to the public? And then do they take a public policy stance to say there's a need for carbon policy? That has gotten us, to this point that we think we've moved the needle. We've helped gauge company performance to the point that nowadays, almost all Fortune 500 companies are measuring, managing, reporting their carbon footprint, which is great. But at that same token is the fact that we're still, busting past 400 parts per million of global atmospheric carbon. And the fact that we need to look at this more scientifically. So it's great that companies have the infrastructure in place to gauge their own progress and to look and to set targets. But realistically, if a company says, hey, we're going to reduce our emissions 20% by 2020 compared to 2005 baseline, well, we're saying, is that enough? Let's look at this through some of the climate science elements that say, hey, here's where we need to get to. Here's where the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, says we need to go in reducing our society's emissions to achieve a mitigation of climate change or greenhouse gases to a 2-degree level. And this is kind of the groundbreaking stuff that we're releasing with this report.
So what are science-based carbon targets?
You hear a lot of times 350. So 350 parts per million is Bill McKibben. He has an organization called 350.org. It was James Hansen of NASA that originally said, it was a couple hundred thousands of years ago that we last saw anything above 350 parts per million of atmospheric carbon. And at that point in our Earth's history, there was no sea ice. There was no such thing as Arctic sea ice or subarctic sea ice. So in order to get greenhouse gas emissions back to what we call safe levels, science has put together, climate science scientists have put together a number of models. In our case, we are using a 350 parts per million model. There are others that use a 450 parts per million model of atmospheric carbon. And all of that is to say, at any point above 350 or 450 parts per million, you're really in a danger zone where you're looking at the climate warming beyond safe levels, meaning sea level is getting such that cities like Tokyo or New York City or Singapore are all starting to realize dangerous levels of sea level rise. You're seeing more drought patterns, more extreme weather and things of that nature. So the idea is to mitigate to a certain level that will slow that change down.
And is your goal with the study to reach the companies themselves, the investor class, or consumers of these goods, if you had to pick one?
If I had to pick one, I'd say this has been an inside game. This has been more for the companies themselves. As much as I'd like for every consumer to pick this up and take a look and try to understand, this is an inside baseball concept. This is the companies, the sustainability professionals that are out there that are trying to do goal setting and target setting within their company, they're going to look at this and try to take something away from it. And hopefully that will be to say, hey, okay, we've had absolute goals, meaning we are going to reduce our emissions 10%. If that doesn't mean enough, let's try to take a science-based goal or science-based approach, which a lot of companies are already saying that they, because as a result of this study, they're going to take a look at that. And GE is one of those. Johnson & Johnson is another one. As I mentioned, Autodesk is already doing it. And we've got a handful of others that are already in the wings saying, oh, sustainability context, this could be the wave of the future.
And to all the CEOs listening right now, what kind of message could you give them from your study? What kind of conclusions can you draw in terms of a company doing the right thing, being as vigilant as they can on their sustainability efforts and their financial success?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the most interesting conclusions from this study was the fact that I think it was 25 of the 49 companies that rated sustainably on this study had also increased revenues since 2005. So we're looking at emissions and revenue growth back to 2005. And there is evidence of decoupling, what we call decoupling. So
maybe you can explain what decoupling means, not only from your study, but in line with what the government decoupling efforts were as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So for us, when we say decoupling, essentially, if there is a carbon budget or carbon allowance at the company level, you'll have, the way this metric is set up is essentially a company will have a certain carbon allowance and they have to achieve carbon reductions over a certain period of time. If they achieve those reductions, some might say, well, they're only achieving those reductions because they're shrinking as a company and they're making less money year on year. What this study has shown or proven is that that's not necessarily the case. There's several instances, Unilever, Autodesk, several others, where companies are actually growing their revenue while reducing their emissions. So the decoupling is essentially the ability to grow in one area as revenue while simultaneously or concurrently reducing in another area emissions. So it's really kind of remarkable And that's what we strive to think is the golden egg of sustainability, right? So you can achieve financial security and sustainability as a company and increase shareholder value while also reducing your environmental impact. And that goes beyond carbon, and that goes to waste, and that goes to water as well.
Where people keep repeating that you'll never fall in love, and everyone keeps retreating, but you still can't get enough. Can't. When tragedy becomes you, don't let it bring you down. Love can't cure your problem. You're so lucky I'm around. Yeah.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mike Bellamente. He's the executive director of Climate Counts. We're talking about his organization's 2013 carbon study. So, Mike, how did you choose these 100 companies? It wasn't just the 100 largest companies, right?
No, and that's a very good thing to point out, Alex, is that, okay, so we have 100 of these companies. If we wanted to look at 5,000 of these companies, back to 2005, it would be much more difficult to do, largely because, you know, it's only the forward thinking or the companies that are really have their act together that are disclosing and being that transparent with their emissions. So if anything, the companies that we looked at are considerably some of the most forward thinking out there. And it's not to shame them by ranking them in order of 1 to 100. We're just saying, you know, here's based on what's available, the data that's available, some companies are still performing unsustainably, regardless if they're being transparent or not.
Let's talk about some of the good guys from your study and some of the companies that didn't score so well. Let's name names.
You want to name names, all right. So Unilever is a well-known in sustainability circles. Autodesk is kind of one of the leading companies. They're a software company actually based out of California. And they were one of the first to adopt a science-based methodology for carbon assessment within their own. It's called CFACT. And I encourage your listeners to check out the work they've done. Unilever is more of a house of brands. They own brands like Ben & Jerry's or Body X or Ragu. They have over 400 different brands worldwide. And one of the remarkable things about what Unilever has done is their CEO, Paul Polman, a Dutch guy, he says, you know, hey, capitalism has gotten us so far, but by no means is it a panacea. We have to realize that there's certain things that increasing shareholder value doesn't square with. And one of those is the what we call the externalization or internalization of things like carbon emissions or waste or social inequities and things of that nature. So what he's done through their sustainable living initiative is to say, hey, by 2020, we want to increase or double the size of our business while at that same time reducing by half our environmental footprint. It's that kind of leadership that's transforming how people or how CEOs, true 21st century CEOs, are changing the game and changing the mindset of how business is done. And you're starting to see it with other B Corps that are out there. In terms of companies that aren't performing so well, we are surprised, I think, a little bit to see Weyerhaeuser, Molson Coors, UPS, Bank of America, all notable performers in the sustainability world. I mean, they all have some kind of corporate social responsibility. UPS, for example, have been listed as a carbon leader on the CDP Global 100 Index. They've also been listed on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. But this is a very, this study is a very unique way of looking at things. And we don't shy away from the fact that, hey, you know, we're looking at something in a way that we're saying it doesn't matter how you're rated. Mother Nature doesn't care necessarily about ratings. Mother Nature, what we're dealing with, what we're coming up against with regard to climate change is a matter of physics, pure and simple. And if we're not reducing emissions enough as a society, or each company isn't carrying their share of the load, then we have to look at ways that we're going to be able to do that more effectively. And what we're thinking we've done with this study is created a roadmap, or at least gotten the discussion and dialogue started with companies that we've rated to say, hey, are you using science-based targets, of which very few of the companies on this list are. If not, why not?
Are you giving these performance scores based on sectors or what they produce? Like, I see that Chevron ranks 31st, but Molson Coors or Wells Fargo are way at the back. And I'm assuming that Chevron probably has a much bigger carbon footprint than a brewer or a banker.
What we're looking at with this study is scope 1 and 2 emissions. And for your listeners, there's traditionally three scopes of emissions. Scope 1 is owned and operated. So that's your manufacturing plants, your on-site combustible emissions. Your scope 2 would be purchased electricity. So if I'm operating and I'm buying electricity from the grid, there's certain emissions associated with that. Scope 3, and this is where Chevron comes into play, or any bank or financial institution, scope 3 is either your supply chain upstream or your downstream emissions, so your consumer use. So if you look at a company like Chevron, they don't necessarily burn a ton of carbon. They might do some refining, but essentially they're selling it off to a utility or selling it off to somebody else who's the people that are driving the cars. They're combusting the fuel that is creating the emissions.
But if they had an oil tanker spill in the Arctic or the North Sea this year, would that cut into their performance score, or is this basically just purely carbon being burned?
This is purely carbon being burned.
So pollution is not a factor in this.
That's exactly right. And that's a very crucial point, because as your listeners, you know, read through the study, all the frequently asked questions, all the assumptions at the front end will tell you why we've done what we've done. Because any rating has its limitations, and we've been doing this rating process for our traditional ratings process for 7 years, as I mentioned. And without fail, there's somebody that comes to me and says, "Well, how can a company score well on this scorecard, yet on the Rainforest Alliance scorecard they'll score poorly?" Well, because Rainforest Alliance is looking at the number of trees burned down or cut down in the Amazon rainforest, whereas we're looking at how companies are managing their carbon emissions.
You can only do so much, right? And so if somebody's looking to invest in a company or to do a lot of business with a particular company, they should be probably looking at several of these rating systems, not just yours, right?
That's exactly right. And you make another good point there, is that we're looking at some point, the idea is to get to the point that we have a catch basin or a catch-all rating that will capture everything that an investor needs to make an informed decision. And one of those things is risk, right? And there's been a lot of talk out there about this idea of stranded assets. So if a company is heavily invested in fossil fuels, or as a byproduct of production, or as a function of their operations, they require a great deal of fossil fuel usage. That will pose as a long-term risk on their balance sheet. And some have even stated that as we get further down this road and closer to 2050 or whatever scientific thresholds we need to reduce carbon emissions, they'll be more exposed. Those companies will be more exposed if they don't figure out a way to employ alternative energies or renewable fuels, or figure out a way to keep that from being a liability as opposed to what it is today, an asset on their balance sheet.
Well, it's important work. I suggest our listeners go to climatecounts.org. We'll also link to it at seachangeradio.com and check out the world's first science-based ranking of corporate carbon emissions. Mike Bellamente of climatecounts.org. Mike, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Alex, thanks for having me. It's been a great time.
Took my chances on a big jet plane. Don't ever let them tell you that they're all the same. The sea was red and the sky was gray. I wondered how tomorrow could ever follow today. The mountains and the canyons start to tremble and shake.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Lee Fondakowski. She's a writer, a screenwriter, and a playwright. And her latest project is Spill, which chronicles the BP oil spill. And it debuts March 12th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Lee, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's good to be here.
You have previously taken on politically charged projects like the Laramie Project, and that was based on Matthew Shepard's murder. And now you've taken on a project dealing with oil spill. What inspired you to try to approach such a large project like an oil spill on stage?
You're right. I have done pieces in the past that have a political charge to them. I guess the way I would think about it is moments in history, moments in American history that are these sort of watershed moments where these, you know, big events happen and there's a lot of dialogue around the country about them. And I guess my drive, my motivation as an artist is to say, okay, well, what is the role that the artist can play in the national conversations around these events? And I think with the case of the BP oil spill, it was a conversation that I think the whole world was watching while the oil was spewing into the Gulf, and it was this unstoppable, you know, technological disaster. But as of July 15th, when the oil, you know, we stopped seeing that spill cam on the bottom corner of our screens, it was like, oh, everybody just, you know, breathed a sigh of relief, like, thank God that's over. And my experience in visiting the people of the Gulf is that it was just beginning at that point for them, and is still an ongoing story. So my question about the role of theater in the national dialogue about this is to kind of keep the story alive and to keep tracking the story as it's unfolding, as opposed to, you know, a media approach that's like in and out. It's the longevity of getting to know the people and the place and trying to bring that story, you know, to the rest of the country.
So how do you plan to get this story out to the rest of the country? It's starting on stage in Baton Rouge, but do you have goals to roll it out nationally?
I do have goals to roll it out nationally. I'm collaborating with a visual artist on this project, which is a little bit different than what we did on Laramie. So we collected interviews, and I wrote a play based on the interviews and court documents. And my collaborator, Reva Wartell, who's a visual artist, she painted oil paintings of the interviewees. So there'll be an art installation and there'll be a play. And when the audience leaves the theater, the art installation will be set up at intermission. So they'll have this, you know, kind of time of contemplation to be with the images of the people they just saw portrayed on stage. But our goal was to first bring the play back to Louisiana. We did interview people in a number of Gulf states, but the bulk of our interviews were done in southern Louisiana. So we really wanted to share it with the people of Louisiana first. And then our hope is to bring it to London. A lot of our interviewees expressed a strong desire to have their words, you know, portray it on stage in London, and then to bring it to New York and the rest of the country. And we have, you know, we're in the process of kind of mapping out the various theaters and partners that we'll have for that rollout.
So you say that the fundamental story of your play is the story of man versus nature. And at the core of this question is, what's the true human and environmental cost of oil? How do you start to tackle something like that through a narrative in an hour and a half or 2 hour play?
The first act of the play is really the disaster aspect of the oil rig. There were a chain of decisions that were made to save money that ultimately led to the blowout. It wasn't a single decision, but it was a chain of decisions that led to the blowout. So the first act is you get to know the people of the place, you get to know the guys on board, and then at the end of the first act is the rig explosion, and the end of the second act, and the second act is the oil spill. And I guess for me, having known very little about oil drilling, I didn't really realize that, like, you know, fracking and, you know, work being done with tar sands and things like that, that deep water drilling is actually a new science. It's different from offshore drilling. Deep water drilling is sort of called the new frontier, and it's like it's space travel. And there's only, you know, maybe 20 wells drilled at this depth ever in history. So the complexity of the technology was really a discovery for me. I had no idea. So the question that the piece poses is, as we develop these technologies to go into the Arctic and to you know, extract oil and gas through these unconventional means, that we as a culture, as a human race, sort of take a step back and say, okay, we have the technology, but is it really worth the risk? And I don't think your average person who just fills up their gas tank and uses disposable plastic and turns on the lights in their house thinks about those questions, because those questions aren't really presented to us. The knowledge behind where our energy comes from is not really known. It's not really talked about, you know, as a topic of conversation at your kitchen table. So the piece is trying to expose that the technology is actually, in my opinion, getting ahead of us. And in the case of the BP spill, I think that's obvious, because they had the technology to drill that deep, but not the technology to stop an oil spill if it happened at that depth.
It's been a pretty depressing story following the oil spill from its genesis. But what kind of silver linings, what kind of positive feelings did you get as you crossed your last T's and dotted your last I's on the piece?
Well, the people of Louisiana have been through so much. You know, they go through hurricanes, they have this incredible land loss, coastal erosion crisis there. And someone said, one of our interviewees said that when it was 5 years, exactly 5 years after Katrina, when the BP spill happened, and it was like being stabbed in the exact same wound twice. And so it does start to feel like, God, how much more can these people live through? But the resiliency of the people to say, okay, this happened. It's not just BP's fault. You know, Louisiana allowed, you know, this relationship between big oil and the state to prosper for many, many, many decades. And so it has been a time of soul searching for a lot of people in Louisiana. Like, what have we done to our land, and how can we take a step back now and change? And I'm hoping that their self-reflection becomes a microcosm for the rest of us, because, you know, these things don't touch us as close to home in other parts of the country, but any you know, major city in along the coast is going to be facing the same kind of crisis that Louisiana is facing now. And I'm hoping that their resiliency and their self-reflection becomes a kind of wake-up call for the rest of us.
Well, the play is called Spill, and the writer-director is Lee Fondakowski. Lee, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's great to chat with you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Melvin Sparks, M. Ward, and the Dave Rawlings Machine. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others.
and tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.